Well, we welcome you back. This is now the fifth lesson, this End Times Explained equipping class. This is where we've been studying the subject of end times for a whole month and haven't talked about end times at all. But there is a reason for that. We're trying to, I think, at least, and you're stuck with me, do this study the right way. Really getting to, you know, why do we arrive at these end times views and conclusions? Why do all of us believe what we do about end times? And for majority of people, it's going to boil down to this thing called hermeneutic, how you study, how you interpret the Bible, the rules and principles for interpretation. And certainly with eschatology, this is why good men come to differ on these things. They're approaching the Bible with different rules and principles for interpretation. It's something I feel compelled to help us figure this out first. Stick with me. I believe it will pay dividends in all of the future studies when we're getting into end times. Now, we can't do much recap right now. Time is too short, but just to reframe and reset up what we have in store for today. When it comes to how you should interpret the Bible, we've landed on this thing called the literal, grammatical, historical method of interpretation, which is actually common to all evangelicals. Just the question, though, is how consistently should you apply this hermeneutic to the Bible? We've displayed that if you take the whole Bible in a consistently literal sense, it's going to lead you, for example, to a premillennial understanding. And that includes a view of the kingdom that sees Israel restored among the nations, the Messiah ruling on earth. But others advocate for a less than literal sense of many Old Testament prophecies and promises, and that's going to lead them to an amillennial or postmillennial position and a different view of the kingdom altogether. In one way or another, promises made to Israel will get transferred to the church, so we have a divergence. We ask, how do these other groups justify not taking the Old Testament literally? And look, we're not saying they're playing fast and loose with the Bible. But they claim this is how the New Testament interprets the Old Testament. This is how the apostles who wrote the New Testament, how they viewed the Old Testament promises. They interpreted them non-literally. They spiritualized them, applied them to the church. So if that's what they did, why shouldn't we do the same? And so we started and spent a lot of time last week understanding that position, their position. It's known as, you know, New Testament priority. That's where the New Testament takes interpretive priority over the Old Testament. And it's used effectively to reinterpret the plain, literal meaning of the Old Testament. Now, we also spent plenty of time last week appreciating but rejecting that view. Do not hold to New Testament priority. If you weren't here last week, it behooves you to go listen to that, because we establish some of the theological and biblical problems with that position. But one thing we didn't get to do is to look at the exegetical problems. Really, meaning by that, just most important issue is this really how the New Testament writers use the Old Testament? Do they really quote the Old Testament in a non-literal, non-contextual manner? Because I can affirm the logic that if there is a clear, consistent pattern of the New Testament spiritualizing the Old Testament or using the Old Testament non-contextually, then why don't we do the same? Yep, I get that. But the question is that the case? Is that really what happens? And so after showing that the biblical and theological problems with the New Testament priority view, what's left to do and the most important thing to do is just kind of go through the verses one by one, look at the key verses they use to support that claim and evaluate them, do some proper Bible study, and is that the case? Is there this pattern of apostolic exegesis where they're interpreting the Old Testament spiritually, non-literally, which would seemingly justify the claims of amillennials or postmillennials? Or to the contrary, can it be displayed that the New Testament writers, they actually use the Old Testament in a very consistent, clear manner, in a way that's consistent with literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutics all the time, which would affirm a premillennial position, for example? Did they use the Old Testament literally and contextually, which would mean that we should do the same? So that's what we're going to try and get into this afternoon. We'll break this up into three parts, like I've kind of been doing. So here's a part one for you, that the pattern of the New Testament's use of the Old. The pattern of the New Testament's use of the Old. What is this pattern of how the New Testament writers used the Old Testament? Last time we looked at the claims of some covenant theologians and others who rely on New Testament priority and try to let them speak for themselves, define their views, give their own support. And when you read their writings, they always rely on the same short list of key verses to affirm, yeah, the New Testament reinterprets the Old Testament. Like there's Joel 2 with Acts 2, Amos 9 with Acts 15, Hosea 11 with Matthew 2, and so on. You get this little group of texts. And as you go through these texts, they make the argument that the New Testament writers are spiritualizing the Old Testament, or at least taking it non-literally, non-contextually. They say that's the pattern of Old Testament usage. And so again, that's why we are justified in doing the same. And remember, they take that pattern and then they run with it. But they believe they're equipped by the apostolic hermeneutic. We're just doing what the apostles did. We're taking it further, but we're on the same trajectory. And so because of this, now to kind of answer that, the way I originally envisioned this lesson going was just, all right, well, let's just pull up this list of verses, go through them one by one, and see where they're claiming support for the idea that the New Testament spiritualizes the Old. Let's kind of cover the top verses. And we're still going to do that. We'll get into that at the tail end of our time today that will bleed into next week. So we're still going to do that. But in my own further studies, I was reminded, I wanted to start off here by mentioning this, just how exaggerated the claims are that the New Testament uses the Old non-literally. That we have this very clear pattern of the apostles using a non-literal hermeneutic with the Old Testament. Because when you read those who hold to a New Testament priority, you get the impression like, oh, there must be dozens, if not hundreds of verses they're talking about here where the New Testament spiritualizes the Old. But that's not the case at all. It's like the overwhelming majority of the times that the New Testament quotes the Old, it is in a very clearly literal, contextual manner. And that's an uncontested fact in a way that could be discerned by literal hermeneutics. How many times does the New Testament quote the Old Testament? It's hard to say because there's allusions. Sometimes they're just making an allusion. It's hard to tell, like, is this a real quote? But, you know, still, most people will agree there's around 300 to 350 quotations. And there's like thousands of allusions, but 300, 350 quotations of the Old Testament. So what if you actually went and studied every single one of those 300 to 350 quotes of the Old Testament? What do you think you'd find? What pattern would emerge? Well, just to get us going here, I want to give you the results of three studies, three authors who did just that. They inductively studied every single one of those 300-odd quotes of the Old Testament. What did they find? Well, first would be the book I read in seminary, Roy Zuck, his book, Basic Bible Interpretation. He found 295 quotes of the Old Testament in the New. And what was the pattern of how they use the Old Testament? There's no pattern. They use the Old Testament in many different ways and for many different purposes. There's no single pattern. They did not quote the Old Testament in any sort of monolithic way. There's a variety of ways. But what was unified, though, the kicker, according to him at least, is that of these 295 quotes, he did not find a single example where the New Testament writer redefines or reinterprets the Old Testament text. No cases of spiritualization. The second author, G.K. Beale, did a similar study. Now, in the end, he found, of the 300-odd quotes, he found 12 passages where the New Testament might use the Old Testament non-contextually. He didn't say that's the case, but 12 texts that merit close examination. You can see how someone might conclude spiritualization. I think that's a fair, honest admission. But look, 12 out of 300 passages is nowhere near a hermeneutical pattern. I don't think we can call that the apostolic hermeneutic based on 12 passages. It seems like the default pattern is, as the apostles did, take the Old Testament overwhelmingly literally and contextually. Beale says this, quote, "It is often claimed that an inductive study of the New Testament reveals a predominantly non-contextual exegetical method. But in fact, of all the many Old Testament citations and allusions found in the New Testament, only a very few plausible examples of non-contextual usage have been noted by critics," end quote. So what he's saying, look, and we're going to I'll show you examples pretty soon, but even the other side admit that the vast majority of New Testament quotes of the Old are just plain literal quotes, or using it in a contextual manner, a manner consistent with literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutics. It's a very small subset that are even contested. And they're trying to draw like everything from this small little group of texts. We're just making the point here, like, let's not let things get blown out of proportion. I think third, the most helpful and thorough study was done by my old professor, Michael Vlock. He wrote this recent book called The Old in the New. He found 357 quotes of the Old Testament, and he inductively studied each one. He identified, he said, 14 cases where non-contextual usage was plausible. It doesn't mean it is the case. He just found like it's plausible. He sees how a person could interpret them as the New Testament writers spiritualizing the Old. He doesn't believe that's the case. He'll go on to argue each of those cases as just an equally strong case on the other side that this was still a contextual, literal usage. But he sees how others can make a case for spiritualization. I think that's fair and honest. But think about this. That means of the 357 Old Testament quotes, you've got 343 where the New Testament writers cited the Old Testament in a contextual manner, a manner consistent with literal hermeneutics, in a manner that fits the author's intent, without a doubt. That sounds like that is the real pattern of how the New Testament uses the Old, right? Vlock is fair to admit that there are 14 passages where it is plausible that the New Testament uses the Old non-contextually. Cases can be made in both directions. Okay, again, that's fair. But where then is the fair and honest admission coming from those on the other side that, hey, 98% of times when the New Testament quotes the Old, it's a literal, contextual manner, according with authorial intent and literal hermeneutics. Again, that's the real hermeneutical pattern, but the other side makes no such honest admission. There are many different ways the New Testament cites the Old, but the overarching pattern is literal, contextual, not spiritual. Certainly not allegorical, not even spiritual. And look, we're talking about passages that deal with prophecy, promises to Israel. So the real pattern is clear. It's just saying, what do you think of a theological system whose foundation seems to rely on like cherry-picking a few verses, a few handful of contested examples, but then ignoring that the lion's share of examples that are to the contrary? I mean, that to assert that from this little group of 14 passages, that is the way the New Testament writers handled the Old Testament. They clearly spiritualized the whole thing. And then to base your theology off of that seems a little short-sighted, intellectually dishonest, or at least, very least, not very compelling. And again, they take this to be the apostolic hermeneutic. This is how we too should regard the Old Testament, especially promises to Israel and prophecy, not literally, spiritually. They take that principle and they run really far with it, and it leads them to all their positions. But bottom line, those who believe in New Testament priority claim this pattern from a very small group of contested texts, and meanwhile they ignore the dominant pattern that emerges from how the New Testament quotes the Old in an overwhelming number of cases. So, you know, like, shouldn't we start there? Why should this whole discussion be framed around this handful of contested passages? Why not start by framing this whole discussion around the 98% of times where the New Testament quotes the Old contextually? Like, shouldn't we build our understanding of how the apostles understood the Old Testament off of that? That does not mean we're going to ignore those handful of contested passages. We're not. We're going to look at them. But when these contested passages get all the attention, like they most often do, their weight in determining the pattern of apostolic exegesis just gets blown way out of proportion. And we don't want to do that. That's why I wanted to start by mentioning that. So look, part one, step one, what is the real pattern of the New Testament's use of the Old? There are many different ways and reasons the New Testament authors quoted the Old. But the overwhelming pattern is that they did so literally, contextually, meaning it fitting the context of the original quote, in a manner consistent with literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutics. and that therefore we should do the same. We are affirmed in doing the same. That should be easily at least the default. Now, like I said, we are still going to cover those contested passages, but I want to spend a little more time appreciating just how predominantly, literally, and contextually the New Testament authors do use the Old Testament. So here's a second part, and I'll give you little notes just so you'll have these in advance, but part two, the categories of the New Testament's use of the Old. The categories. Because like I said, the New Testament writers use the Old Testament in a variety of ways, but it always remains consistent with literal hermeneutics. Still, I think it's useful to survey the different categories of this usage just to give you a sense of the different ways and reasons for which the New Testament authors quote the Old, but it's showing how they stay true to authorial intent. So I want to survey some categories. Different authors will find different ways to categorize New Testament usage. Here I'm leaning on, again, Dr. Vlock's categories. And through his inductive study of every Old Testament usage, he finds these seven categories. I want to just give you an understanding of them, a few examples. This will really pay off later when we start getting into all the cases of how the New Testament uses the Old in practice. So let's kind of quickly go through these. The different categories of New Testament usage of the Old. The first is like straight up literal prophetic fulfillment. It's what you think of when you think of the word fulfilled, even though it's used in many different ways, but literal prophetic fulfillment. So we're just talking about when the New Testament quotes an Old Testament prophecy as being straightforward, literally fulfilled. There's just a ton of examples to choose from. I think this afternoon we're going to pick on Matthew's gospel, partly because I'm preaching through Matthew, so I've already seen all this, as have you. But Matthew is very well known for containing some of those highly contested passages. So it's good to get into Matthew, but also show that, honestly, that the baseline of Matthew's usage of the Old Testament is still literal, contextual, and so forth. So you can look at these quickly if you want. I'm going to just reference them, but you can open to Matthew to follow along. And we'll read some. I'll just summarize others, but you can start in Matthew chapter 3. You have Matthew 3:3, quoting Isaiah 40, verse 3, where Matthew is giving his own commentary on the ministry of John the Baptist. And after introducing John, he quotes Isaiah 40, verse 3, telling us, this is the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ready the way of the Lord. And that's quoting Isaiah 40, verse 3. You study that verse in its original context, and it's just speaking of a voice calling Israel to prepare for the coming of the glory of Yahweh. John the Baptist is that voice. Jesus is the glory of Yahweh. This is quoted as just a direct, literal fulfillment. Very straightforward. Same thing, Matthew 21, verses 4 and 5. That's quoting Zechariah, chapter 9, verse 9. Triumphal entry, Jesus riding into the city on a donkey. Matthew tells us this took place to fulfill the scriptures. He quotes Zechariah 9:9. You go read Zechariah 9. It promised that there would be a coming king, deliverer. He'd come bringing salvation. But in this juxtaposition with his power, he would come riding not on a horse, but on this donkey, which obviously is an image of his meekness, his humility. But look, that New Testament did not see that as like just spiritual or figurative, like Jesus came literally riding into town on a donkey. He is that deliverer king, and he rode into Jerusalem on an actual donkey. This is direct, literal, prophetic fulfillment. Special note here, it's interesting how Matthew did not quote Zechariah 9, verse 10, the next verse. Because you go read Zechariah 9, that next verse speaks of this king's dominion over all the earth, spreading is peace to all the nations, and that won't be fulfilled until the second coming. It's appropriate that Matthew stopped at verse 9, because that is still to come. And then we won't get into this, but look, all the quotes of Isaiah 53 in the New Testament, they're never spiritualized. It's just straight, literal, prophetic fulfillment. This might be too quick for your notes, but Isaiah 53:1, found in John 12:38, that the servant of God will be rejected by his people. Isaiah 53:7 and 8, found in Acts 8, 32 and 33, that the servant of God would be a suffering servant. Isaiah 53:9, found in 1 Peter 2, verse 22, the servant of God would be sinless and without deceit. Isaiah 53:12 and Luke 22:37, that the servant of God would be numbered with transgressors. You can, I can always give you those notes later if you didn't catch it all. But look, the Jews today, they spiritualize, they allegorize Isaiah 53, believing that that can't be taken literally to refer to an individual Messiah. But you know, the New Testament takes that chapter plainly and straight up literally, contextually. And we're making the case here that that is the pattern of apostolic exegesis, how they interpreted the Old Testament. Now, that pattern continues, meaning that they regard it in a literal, contextual manner, a manner consistent with literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutics. Now, they quote the Old Testament in other ways, ways beyond direct literal fulfillment, but they're not straying from quoting the Old Testament contextually. So here's the second category to show you that as we keep going. Second way they use the Old Testament, how about an affirmation that an Old Testament prophetic text, not yet fulfilled, will be in the future. What this means is there are many Old Testament passages, Old Testament prophecies that speak of things to come. And even from our perspective today, they're still future. They're still forward predicting. They're still awaiting fulfillment. Well, look, sometimes the New Testament writers quoted those passages and they themselves still viewed them as yet future. And they themselves viewed them as literal. They did not spiritualize these expectations. One example would be Matthew 24. There's kind of several places in the Olivet Discourse. Jesus quotes and alludes to Daniel and other prophets, but primarily Daniel's prophecies. Jesus refers to a future tribulation, this thing called the abomination of desolations, the coming of the Son of Man in the clouds. Those all are quotes from expectations found in Daniel of things to come. And Jesus quotes them like and affirms that these are still things to come. And nothing in the text would indicate Jesus intends for us to now understand these things in a non-literal spiritual manner. They're second coming passages. But as we said weeks ago, don't we have the overwhelming precedent of literal fulfillment for first coming prophecies? Remember that? And we get the expectation from Jesus. These are still future and just as literal. These are still things to come. But the point here is we have another category of Old Testament usage where the Old Testament is quoted literally, contextually. Right? Third category, literal application of a timeless moral or theological point. And I think you have that in your notes, but this category, it's actually very simple, but this is the largest category of how the New Testament writers use the Old. It's the largest one. It just means like the Old Testament is full of timeless truth, wouldn't you say? Timeless moral truth, timeless theological truths. This could be truth about the character of God. This could be truth about God's will, universal will for all people. Okay. Well, the New Testament comes along and understands these truths in a literal way and reaffirms them. Like they're still true. They're not spiritualized and the message has not changed, that it views these timeless moral theological points as still true literally and applies them. And too many examples to cover, but again, pretty quick. Matthew 9:13 with Hosea 6, verse 6, which says God desires compassion and not sacrifice. That's true in Hosea 6:6. It's still true. Timeless truth. How about Luke 1:50 with Psalm 103, verse 17? That God's mercy is upon generation after generation. That's still true. That God's mercy is still upon generation after generation. How about the two greatest commands? Luke 10:27, to love God with all your heart, to love your neighbor as yourself. That is still true. Quoting Deuteronomy 6:5, Leviticus 19:18, still true. Then you read Romans 3, 10 through 19 on your own. Paul quotes like six different Psalms plus Isaiah 59, just building the case from the Old Testament. Everyone's a sinner. Right? You know that passage. None are righteous, not even one. just a scattering of quotes from the Old Testament, Psalms and Isaiah. But he's just showing the Old Testament taught all are sinners. And guess what? He's affirming all are sinners. This is why we need the Savior. But this is the pattern. We're talking about the clear pattern of how the New Testament uses the Old. Different categories, so different ways. But in each category, you have this overwhelmingly literal, plain, straightforward understanding of the Old Testament. It's not getting morphed and transformed and reinterpreted. Straightforward. Okay, number four. Literal reliance on an Old Testament event or statement. Literal reliance on an Old Testament event or statement. This is just the same thing as number three, except instead of referencing an Old Testament timeless truth, New Testament writers sometimes reference Old Testament history, events, people, and whenever they did so, saw them as like literal, real. The New Testament writers viewed the Old Testament as factual history. This is literal history. And so they often quoted it as history in support of, you know, whatever argument they were making. And the point is that they did not allegorize the Old Testament. They did not spiritualize the Old Testament from its history to its prophecy. I'm not going to read this, but, you know, one extended example would be Acts chapter 7, just the sermon of Stephen before he's martyred. You can read that. It's a long chapter, but he's basically just reciting and rehashing Israel's history. Don't even try and write this down, but he quotes Genesis 12, 1, 17, 8, 15, 13 through 14, Exodus 1, 8, Exodus 2, 14, 15, Exodus 32, 23, Amos 5, 25 through 27, Isaiah 66, 1 through 2. Again, I'll share those notes later, but all these quotes, rattling them off, but every time, this literal, contextual, the authorial intent, just taking history as, well, as it was. Different ways they use the Old Testament, but each time, literal, contextual manner. Okay, a couple more categories to go. This one's a big one, number five. Divine correspondence between Israel and Jesus. Not a lot of passages in this, but it's a big category to understand. Divine correspondence between Israel and Jesus. And I'll explain. What does that mean? This is effectively talking about what's known as typology. You've heard that term before? We'll talk about it more in the future, about typology. Typology is a real dimension of how the New Testament sometimes views Old Testament events or people. Now, in a future lesson, we'll talk much more about the right and wrong uses of typology because it gets wrongly used. But in short, real biblical typology is where the New Testament writers point out some divinely intended correspondence between an Old Testament reality and Jesus. So certain Old Testament realities were meant to prefigure the Messiah in different ways. Now, keep in mind, this does not necessitate that when Jesus shows up, the Old Testament reality loses all of its original meaning and significance. Certainly, when we're talking about Israel here with unconditional promises made to Israel, that's not the case. You know, some teach that, hey, when the type comes, the anti-type passes away. And again, we'll talk more about typology later, but we would differ on that. So this is an important category for how some New Testament writers quote the Old Testament, that they do point out that there's a correspondence between Israel and Jesus. Again, you'll hear covenantalists say Jesus is they'll say the church is the true Israel. We disagree with that. That's for a future study. They'll also say that Jesus is the true Israel. And that needs to be qualified, but we would kind of agree with that. That the New Testament sees Jesus as the ultimate Israelite. And I'll explain, but New Testament does see Jesus as this like ultimate Israelite. Honestly, Jesus in the New Testament, he's seen as like a second Adam, second Abraham, a second Moses, a second David, and a second Israel. He's the one who comes to do what all those entities failed to do. He will succeed where all others failed in actually bringing about God's plans and promises. And it was always meant to be this way. National Israel, they had their role. They had their role in God's redemptive plans for the nations. They failed in that role. Just like King David failed in being this perfect mediator over God's people. He was a failed king too. But where all these failed, the Messiah would succeed. Keep in mind, though, a caveat. national Israel right now is hardened in unbelief. They're under judgment. They failed, but we do not believe their failure and hardening is final. Yes, they failed in their role, and they even rejected their own Messiah, but that actually always was God's will. But we also believe it is just as much God's will for them to be eventually restored. Just because Jesus has come and he has succeeded where they failed, yes, in bringing blessing to the nations, that's true. That does not mean God is finished in his plans with that one nation, Israel. This doesn't have to be an either or. It can be a both and. We would affirm that. Anyway, though, going back to this idea of correspondence, the New Testament shows how events in the history of Israel were meant to prefigure events in the life of Jesus, in the life of the Messiah, like on purpose. This is by God's design. As the architect of all things, providentially guiding history, he designed Israel's actual history in certain ways to prefigure the coming Messiah. And this idea to the Israel corresponding to the Messiah, it's not made up in the New Testament. It's not new to the New Testament. The Jews themselves were familiar with this concept. You might call it corporate solidarity, where the one can represent the many and vice versa. And that concept stems from the Old Testament. So just think of the servant songs of Isaiah. Not sure if you're familiar with that, but the servant songs of Isaiah. That's where in Isaiah's prophecies, he speaks of this servant figure. And sometimes, very clearly, the servant refers to Israel. Like nationally, they are the servant of God. That's clear. But other times, it's equally clear this servant is an individual distinct from Israel. Like it's a single person, the Messiah figure, like Isaiah 53, right? But the thing is, like, the same word servant is used for both interchangeably. So there's clearly some correlation or correspondence between this national servant and individual servant. It was baked in. You might ask, what is the correspondence? It's actually answered in Isaiah. It's not a mystery per se what the correspondence would be between the individual servant and the corporate servant, Israel. We learn from Isaiah that it would be the individual servant, his job would be to restore Israel and succeed in bringing salvation to the nations, because God always knew that this corporate servant would fall short. This is nothing other than Isaiah 49, 5 and 6. I'll read it for you, but Isaiah 49, 5 and 6. It says, "Now said the Lord, who formed me from the womb to be his servant." This is talking about the individual servant. "To bring Jacob back to him so that Israel might be gathered to him." He says, "Is it too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel? I will also make you a light of the nations so that my salvation may reach the end of the earth." What it's saying is it was God's design that, yeah, he calls Israel his corporate servant. He knew they were going to fall short, but he was going to call and raise up this seed of Abraham, seed of Adam, seed of David, right? To be this individual servant who would not only restore Israel, but also bring light to the nations. This was always the plan. So look, this correspondence between the Messiah and national Israel, it's nothing new, but you see it now fleshed out and come to life in the New Testament now that Jesus comes. And you can see all the ways where in God's providence, the life of Christ corresponds to the history of Israel in an important way. The New Testament writers like to point out these connections because they serve the purpose of identifying Jesus as the Messiah. Like, this is way beyond coincidence. Like, all these things happening in the life of Jesus that correspond to the history of Israel, what does that tell you? Like, it's not just coincidence. There's divine hand guiding these two. Is that not a proof Jesus is the Messiah? And that is the point. But you see this, most of all, where? Matthew's gospel. Again, it makes sense. One of his main goals is to identify Jesus as the Jewish Messiah, the servant of God, who will restore Israel and bring light to the Gentiles. We've seen that ourselves in Matthew. Matthew is trying to show us Jesus is that individual servant of Isaiah 49. Unlike Israel, he is the servant who walks perfectly in the law of God. He will do what Israel failed to do and extend God's salvation to the nations. Very shortly, we'll see how this category, number 5 here, how this way the New Testament uses the Old, really equips us to handle in greater detail one of the most contested passages when it comes to this issue, and that would be Matthew's use of Hosea 11:1 in chapter 2. We'll get to that in a little bit here. Let's finish up. There's two more categories. They're quick. Number 6, divine correspondence between David and Jesus. This is the same thing as number 5. It's just now we're talking about David, not Israel. But it's that same concept of typology or divine correspondence. Only this time, the New Testament also draws out a connection between the words and events of King David to the Messiah's life. We'll get this way more when we study the Davidic covenant, but God planned for there to be some intended correspondence between the first David and the second David, the son of David, the Messiah. And David himself knew this. He knew, God told him in 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant, that one of his descendants will be raised up after him to reign forevermore, that his house, kingdom, and throne would be established forever all through this son of David to come. So David knew the Messiah would come from him, and he knew that his life would somehow correspond to this future Messiah. And look, David was a prophet. Acts chapter 2, we'll see this in later, greater detail later, but Peter straight up calls David a prophet, speaking of things to come. And Acts 1:16 says, David, the Holy Spirit spoke through the mouth of David concerning Judas. His writings benefited from divine inspiration. So with this in mind, from David's life to David's writings, it should not surprise us to find that there's some correspondence here with the life of Jesus. Much like the history of Israel prefigured the life of the Messiah, so some events of David's life prefigured that of the Messiah. For example, they both were betrayed by a close friend. You see that parallel with Judas drawn out explicitly. Also, in his writings, sometimes David, he's talking about his own life in the Psalms, but at times he will then lapse and talk about the Messiah to come, inserting his own hope of the coming Messiah who would be patterned after him. We'll see some of those examples in greater detail later when we go case by case. Lastly, this is just kind of a quick mention. Number 7, generational fulfillment, minor category. It just speaks how Israel is viewed as a corporate national entity across many generations, which just means that the New Testament writers, they find correspondence between like the state of Israel in the past, the state of Israel in the present. Israel's unbelief in the past has a correspondence to Israel's unbelief in the day of Christ. And it goes from there, but for the sake of time, we'll leave it there. It's a small, you know, simple category about the correspondence between Israel past, present, to the day of Christ. But now, okay, we've saved, that's about 2/3 of our time, a little bit of time left, and then all next week, let's now finally get into the examples, because I did not want to exclude this. This lesson changed a little bit as I got into it. I wanted to front load this and help you further understand categorically and overall how the New Testament uses the Old, overwhelmingly literally. But now let's get into some of these other passages. We'll finish this next week, but let's start here. And part 3, you could say the examples of the New Testament's use of the Old. I'm mostly going to pick on the contested examples, but examples of the New Testament's use of the Old. For the rest of our time here, I think the best way to do this, let's go to Matthew 2. We're going to look at the 4 Old Testament prophetic fulfillments of Matthew 2. The 4 Old Testament prophetic fulfillments of Matthew 2. Matthew 2 is known for being a hot spot of the New Testament use of the Old, because Matthew quotes the Old Testament several different times in Matthew 2, each time in a different way. So talk about pattern. There's no pattern of how they use the Old Testament. 4 different ways, 4 different categories, you might say. But overall, though, Matthew does not deviate from understanding the Old Testament in a literal, contextual manner. We're going to try and show that. What are these 4 examples? Here's where, you know, I gave you that handout just to spare you a little bit. Matthew 2, 5 and 6 with Micah 5:2. Matthew 2, 15 with Hosea 11:1. Matthew 2, 17 and 18 with Jeremiah 3:15. Matthew 2, 23 with this mention of the prophets. Now, I appreciate an author, Arnold Fruchtenbaum. He's a Jewish Christian theologian writing a book called Israelology, the Missing Link in Systematic Theology. He cites Matthew 2 as just this perfect example because it contains examples of the four different ways New Testament quotes the Old. He has four categories. Vlach has seven. Again, that's just how you classify things. But his categories, I think I also put in your notes. Matthew 2 with Micah 5, he sees that's literal prophecy plus literal fulfillment. Matthew 2 with Hosea 11:1, that's literal plus typical fulfillment. Matthew 2 with Jeremiah 3:15, literal plus application. Matthew 2:23 with the prophets is something called summation. However you categorize, though, these usages of the Old Testament, let's look at them one by one. Let's see how Matthew was trying to handle the Old Testament. Was he playing fast and loose? Was he spiritualizing? Or even though he used the Old Testament different ways, was he still handling them in according to the original context? Did he keep the original context and authorial intent in mind, or did he just blow it out of the water and make this about Jesus when it was never meant to be? So let's go through these. We're going to save Hosea 11:1 for last, so a little bit out of order, but we're going to get all four. So go Matthew 2, 5, and 6. I need to turn there as well. With Micah 5, 2. Again, kind of summarizing a little bit for time, but Matthew 2, 5, and 6. You know this one. They said to him, this is of the birth of Jesus, the Magi reporting where the Messiah was supposed to be born. I'm sorry, the scribes reporting where the Messiah is supposed to be born, and they get it right. They said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what has been written by the prophet. Verse 6, this is quoting Micah 5, 2. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah. For out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. First category here, very straightforward. This is that literal prophecy plus literal fulfillment. It's that direct literal fulfillment. There's no really challenge here. There's tons of examples of this. Here's one of them. You read Micah 5, 2. And it was a promise of Messiah that when he's born, he will come from Bethlehem of Judah, not Bethlehem of Galilee. There's another Bethlehem. It's saying that he will specifically come from Bethlehem of Judah. And Matthew quotes this as direct, literal fulfillment. There's no challenges. As simple as that. So this first one is easy. Let's move on. Now, you keep going, though, and most times when Matthew quotes the Old Testament, it's like this, just direct, literal fulfillment. That's the easy category. How about this one? Matthew 2, 17, 18. We'd call this, Fruchtenbaum would call this literal plus application. This is after Herod slaughters the babies. Remember that? After the birth of Jesus, Joseph was warned, don't go back, flee to Egypt. Herod's after you. The Magi likewise were warned, don't go back to Herod. He's wicked. And being tricked, Herod sees this potential threat, like, hey, these people claim they found the king of the Jews. Can't let this stand. So he knows it's Bethlehem. He sends orders to slaughter all the male children 2 years and under in Bethlehem to get rid of this potential king of the Jews. And so we see that in verse 16 explains that. In 17, Matthew says, then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. Verse 18, this now quotes Jeremiah 3:15. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Now, this one on the surface is trickier because you go read Jeremiah 3:15, and it does not appear to be a messianic prophecy at all. Not talking about the Messiah. So what gives? Is Matthew just like ripping Jeremiah 31:15. Have I been saying 3 this whole time? 31:15. I'm not sure what your notes say, but Jeremiah 31:15, out of its original context, is he just like ignoring the original meaning? He's transforming this into some spiritual prediction of the Messiah? No, let's go through this. Spend a little more time here. If you want to turn to Jeremiah 31, you can. I'm going to summarize, though. Let's talk about the context of Jeremiah 31. Jeremiah 31 itself is a most hopeful chapter. The book of Jeremiah overall is full of warnings and condemnation on Judah for their waywardness. They're going to be exiled. This is a done deal. They're going to be exiled and judged. But there's always hope. Jeremiah 31 looks forward to their restoration, that God will restore you. Now, at the time people were hearing this message, though, they weren't very hopeful because they were living under the reality of what's happening. The exile was upon them. Jeremiah 31:15 then inserts some of the very real suffering the people were experiencing with this calamity, you know, befalling them. This is talking about the Babylonian captivity. And during that captivity, turning there myself, during that captivity, men were taken captive out of Jerusalem. So this is the southern kingdom, Judah. The Babylonians are invading. They're taking them captive. And a lot of the poor people were left in the land. And, you know, women, sometimes older women, they were left in the land. They were taking the young men back, at least in this deportation. And so they were coming out of Jerusalem, and they'd marched north through Ramah, Bethlehem, a little bit south of Jerusalem, Ramah, a little bit north of Jerusalem. They would march past the town of Ramah. And at that point, as these young men marched by, the Jewish mothers of Ramah were coming out weeping for all the sons they would never see again. And Jeremiah himself, back in Jeremiah 31:15, pictures this as Rachel weeping for her children. Why? What's up with that? Well, it's a very simple symbol. Rachel was buried in Ramah, and at the time, still, she's seen as the symbol for Jewish motherhood. It's just picturesque. Move on. The brain failed there, but a picturesque way of depicting the mothers of Jerusalem or the mothers of Israel. But look, that's the literal meaning of Jeremiah 31:15. This is a real thing happening. These men are being deported. These women are truly weeping for their sons they will never see again. Now, keep in mind, though, that the following verse, and really the whole chapter of Jeremiah 31, counters all this sadness with hope. Because the next verse basically says, but stop your weeping. Because these sons will one day return. Not tomorrow, but one day these sons will return. That there will be a full restoration. Scattered Israel will be brought back to the land and made full, as God even makes a new covenant with them, which just happens to be in the same chapter, Jeremiah 31. Okay, that's a little bit on the context of Jeremiah 31. What about Matthew's use of Jeremiah 31? First off, Matthew clearly knows the difference between these two situations. He's not confused. They're centuries apart. You've got slaughter versus deportation. Talking about the slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem, right? Slaughter versus deportation. Infants versus young men. Bethlehem versus Ramah. They're different. He knows they're different. Now, what's the connection then? Matthew actually shows that he fully knows and understands Jeremiah 31:15 in its original context. He's not claiming to override or reinterpret that. Just know that for Matthew, the word fulfill, plerao, has a range of meaning, does not mean it all is direct literal fulfillment when he uses the word fulfill. It can be correspondence. But Matthew identifies a single point of contact between these two episodes as the link, and he sees Herod's slaughter of the infants as an application of Jeremiah's message. So we call this literal prophecy plus application. So what is the single point of contact? Because these two episodes are very different in their details. What's the main point of contact? It is the weeping of Jewish mothers. Because once again, with the slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem, we have Jewish mothers weeping for their sons they will never see again. Everything else is different. That's the same thing. But in the context of Jeremiah, same thing. Just as God gave them hope that their weeping would one day be turned into gladness. Now, that time has dawned. Matthew is showing us, like, because of Jesus, that this Messiah, that time has come. He is the one who will eventually wipe away every tear. He's the one who will restore Israel and all of Israel's sons. He's the one who will bring the new covenant. He's the one who will enable God to forgive sin, which leads to death, the ultimate enemy. Look, in the end, Matthew, he's taking Jeremiah 31:15 literally. He understands it contextually, but he's using it to draw an application to present day in the life of Jesus. This is not spiritualization or reinterpretation of the Old Testament. Those who claim Matthew's doing so, usually they themselves have not spent time studying Jeremiah 31 in his context to see the correspondence. Speaking of correspondence, Some would see a note of typology here. For example, Vlock classifies this under correspondence between Israel and Jesus, that we have another tragic event followed by hope. In Israel's history, a tragic event followed by hope. And in the life of Jesus, a tragic event followed by hope. But here is Jesus, though, the one who will right all these wrongs of mankind. And having established that there is a divinely intended correspondence between the history of Israel and the life of Jesus, that's perfectly valid as well. Okay, here's another quick one, and then we'll finish with Hosea 11:1. But Matthew 2:23, go back to Matthew 2, go to the end. So at the very end of Matthew 2, after coming out of Egypt, Jesus winds up in Nazareth. That's where he will be raised. And Matthew says this, Matthew 2:23, "This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets. He shall be called a Nazarene." Now the problem here is, there is no Old Testament prophecy about the Messiah being a Nazarene, coming from Nazareth. And so we wonder, you know, again, what gives? Is Matthew playing fast and loose with the Old Testament? No, this one is pretty simple, and it's an example of summation. A different way they use the Old Testament here, they're summarizing, but it's still contextual. You'll notice in verse 23 how Matthew uses the plural. He's not saying like the prophet Isaiah. He says the prophets, plural. He's referring to the prophets of the Old Testament in a collective sense. He's not quoting a single prophet. He's giving a collective summation of the Old Testament prophets. And put together, the Old Testament prophets taught that the Messiah would be despised and not esteemed by man, just like, in that day, a Nazarene. The connection he's making here is that the fact that the Messiah would effectively come from and be raised in Nazareth, what does that communicate? Nazareth was a backwoods town with nothing going on. Like Nathaniel said, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And people from Nazareth were despised and not esteemed. And that is what the prophet said the Messiah would be. That's the simple connection. Matthew shows he's actually very familiar with the Old Testament scriptures. He knew, in broad brushstrokes, they expected this Messiah, believe it or not, would be despised and not esteemed by man. And lo and behold, here is Jesus in more ways than one, fitting that bill. More important, though, this is another example where Matthew is not spiritualizing the Old Testament or taking it in a non-literal manner. To the contrary, the prophets, like Isaiah 53, Isaiah 49, they literally taught the Messiah would be despised and not esteemed. And Jesus came and was literally despised and not esteemed. Still contextual usage. Now let's finish with the big one. Matthew 2:15 with Hosea 11:1, so let's go there. It won't take us too long to deal with it, especially since we spent all that time understanding the correspondence between Israel and Jesus. But let's go through this. This is the most notable, most challenged passage in Matthew 2. I say it's got to be in the top five of passages others use to claim the New Testament spiritualizes the Old Testament, meaning taking it non-literally, non-contextually. And you know the story, after escaping Herod, Jesus and family go down to Egypt for safety. They wait there until Herod is gone. Then they finally come back to the land coming out of Egypt. That's all fine. But Matthew tells us, though, this was to fulfill something. So Matthew 2:15, "He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Out of Egypt, I call my son." It's quoting Hosea 11:1. Now, kind of same problem here with the Jeremiah passage. You go read Hosea 11:1. You read Hosea 11, it does not seem to have anything to do with the Messiah coming out of Egypt. Rather, Hosea 11, it's about God calling Israel out of Egypt back in the Exodus. It's a historical reference. It's not even predictive prophecy, Hosea 11:1. It's about national Israel. Hosea 11:1 reads, "When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." So clearly, this is not a one-to-one, direct, literal fulfillment. So what is Matthew doing? Is Matthew spiritualizing this Old Testament comment about Israel and transforming this into a prophecy about Jesus or not? Well, again, same thing. Let's start with the context of Hosea 11. Let's go back to understand the original context. What's the book of Hosea all about? It's all about God's relationship with Israel, which is pictured in the relationship between Hosea and Gomer. Gomer was this adulterous, unfaithful wife, but nonetheless, Hosea redeemed her and restored her to honor anyway. And the message is, so God will do with Israel. At this time, Israel was in full-blown spiritual adultery. Still, God's going to redeem her. He's going to call her back one day, restore her to honor. It's kind of the main point. Hosea 11 fits right into this picture. Hosea 11:1 looks back to the time when God called this nation to himself. When Israel was a youth, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son. A little mixing of metaphors now where Israel is pictured not as the bride, but as the son of God. That comes from Exodus. I think it's 4. There's precedent for that. Israel is God's son. God cared for them, fed them, loved them. But they kept refusing God. They went after other gods. God laments their unfaithfulness and declares, well, you're going to exile. This time it will be Assyria, the first time, Assyria. But the sword will come against them, he says, but not forever. Like all the Old Testament prophets, it ends with a note of hope. I'll read it for you, but Hosea 11, verse 8, God says, though, how can I give you up, O Ephraim, which really refers to Israel, even though, as he traces the history of Israel, they've gone wayward. Hey, the sword is coming. You're going to exile. But still, God says, but how can I give you up? Just like Gomer, how can I give you up? I set my love on you. And so we know they will be restored. And it connects that that restoration will take place through the Messiah. We know that. Only the Messiah will be the one to restore the hearts of the people back to their God for real. Now, it's true, when you read and study Hosea 11, it does not seem to be talking about Jesus, and it's not. But we already established it was God's plan for the Messiah. The word is to recapitulate, almost relive the history of Israel, the story of Israel, that Jesus as the Messiah was meant to identify with Israel, to be this true Israelite, and then to be the one to succeed where they failed. That would include restoring Israel and also bringing light to the Gentiles. He would, but concerning Israel, he would restore Israel to honor and spiritual faithfulness before God. So again, think about this correspondence between Israel and Jesus. We established that in category 5 before, right? This divinely intended correspondence between Israel and Jesus. That there was always meant to be this corporate solidarity between the seed figure, the son figure, and Jesus. Going from the seed promise in the garden to Abraham's seed to the son of David. We saw that in the servant songs, that sometimes the servant is referred to the individual Messiah, sometimes to the nation. There's correspondence. There are many clear parallels or points of correspondence between Israel's history and Christ's life. Matthew highlights many of them in his gospel. But again, in all the ways Israel failed in her role, Jesus comes and he will succeed. He comes as the ultimate seed of Abraham, the ultimate Israelite, who will bring blessing to the nations. This is what Matthew's trying to show. Now, I want to mention here that, ironically, like covenantalists, amillennials, they will agree with this interpretation that Matthew is more typologically using Hosea. And that's kind of what we're teaching here. But they take the implications way further. They teach that Jesus is not just the ultimate Israelite, but the true Israel. And since we, the church, are united to Christ, we are the true Israel. And all the promises that were explicitly made with national Israel get all transferred to us. It's almost as if Jesus, the Messiah, came as that true Israelite to bring blessing to all the nations, but the one nation of Israel was kind of left out, forsaken. Yeah, there's a believing remnant of Israel, but the big problem we have with that position is that God made too many clear, unilateral, unconditional promises to bless and restore this nation among the nations through the Messiah. And Gomer is not going to be divorced at the end of the day. She can be wayward for a long time, but Gomer is going to be restored, redeemed, and put in a place of honor. That's God's prerogative. That's Hosea's prerogative, but that's the plan. So in all, we would say they take this typology way too far, that we agree Jesus was meant to correspond to Israel, but not in a way that erases the promises to Israel. Again, we'll get into typology much more in two lessons, but we would say we do see some typology fulfilled in the New Testament, making explicit this correspondence between Israel and Jesus. That is true, and that is what's going on here. Isn't it interesting how before Herod slaughtered the infants, there was Pharaoh who issued this edict to slaughter all the newborn boys of the Hebrews. Remember that? But one child was saved, going on to be Israel's deliverer in the Exodus, Moses, that he would lead God's people in an exodus, delivering them out of Egypt from slavery. And now comes Jesus. He's spared from an edict of another Pharaoh, you might say, Herod. And for this, Jesus goes down to Egypt. But Jesus is very much like a second Moses, a greater Moses. He will lead God's people in a second exodus, a greater exodus, delivering them not from slavery to Egypt or Rome, but from sin. And as a way to signify Jesus is this promised Savior, God worked it out that Jesus would be exiled to Egypt and have to flee there, also that he could be called out, and it could be said of him, "Out of Egypt I called my son." That just as God set his love on Israel as his son and called him from Egypt to serve him, so God now has set his love on his greater son, Jesus, and he's calling him from Egypt to lead his people in this final exodus, bringing them to the heavenly promised land. And just as God protected and preserved Moses and later Israel, so God will protect and preserve his chosen son, Christ. Little did Herod know, he had no chance of actually killing Jesus in that moment. But overall, Matthew is showing us that Jesus coming out of Egypt, it's not a coincidence. This is a divinely intended correspondence, affirming. There's too many coincidences. It shows you, you're really seeing the hand of God, the pattern of God over history. This is another one. Matthew shows us many that who is Jesus? There's no doubt. He is this one. He is this Messiah. But Matthew is not changing, transforming, or reinterpreting the Old Testament text. He understands it literally. He understands Hosea in context by showing Jesus as a second Moses. But in all, how he referenced Hosea 11:1 is still consistent with literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutics, which understands and handles types, but doesn't let them go too far. That's a distinction we'll have to make in a few lessons. We're out of time here. This gives you a little taste. If you didn't like this, don't come back next week, because that's all we're going to do. But, you know, we're getting into now some of like the key verses that are used, again, to affirm the New Testament reinterprets the old. We should do the same. New Testament does spiritualize the old. We should do the same. If you buy that, you're going to go a different direction with end times conclusions. You get the drift now. So I think just the most honest thing to do is just let's go to these key verses. Hit the top ones one by one. Study them in context like we did this afternoon and see, like, is that the case? So far, already in Matthew 2, I have argued no, it's not the case. We have a few more to go through, enough to cover in a full lesson next week, and then moving on. So hopefully that benefits you. This is not the end, but the end for now. So let's pray and finish up. Heavenly Father, we thank you for Christ. We again want to set our mind on Christ this afternoon, though we can get into the weeds of some Bible study and hermeneutic study. Still, don't let our hearts wander too far from just worship of Christ, remembering. At the end of the day here, we all agree that Christ is this Messiah, this Savior, the one called out of Egypt to be our deliverer, be the one to save us from far greater slavery than any nation, but slavery to sin, slavery to Satan. We need to pause, remember what's really going on here, but we all cling to that the Christ has come, and in him our total salvation. So we thank you for sending this Redeemer. We thank you for not abandoning that promise and being faithful to your word. And we love you, we love him. I'll ever increase our resolve to follow him, and may we represent him until he returns for us. We long for that as well. But just fix our eyes on Christ, indeed the author and perfecter of our faith, even as we study him and his word, his coming. We look forward to his second coming now. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.